The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your often bi-weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined today by IJ attorney Robert Ever Johnson, as well as Sheldon Gilbert, director of IJ's Center for Judicial Engagement. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to sign up for the accompanying email newsletter at ij.org/short-circuit. Sheldon, let's kick things off in the Ninth Circuit.
All right. Mary and John Fruden are the parents of two children. And when their children were in the third grade and the fifth grade, the school announced that it would have a new uniform policy. And so the policy required the students to wear kind of these polo shirts with three things on them. Number one, the name of the school. Number two, a really awful picture of a gopher, and you can see this picture online. And three, a motto for the school, which is "Tomorrow's Leaders." Mary and John, on behalf of their children, objected to the uniforms on multiple grounds. And so when the first couple weeks of the uniform policy was in place, they sent their kids to school just as they normally would, not wearing the uniform, which caused more and more angst on the part of the principal, who finally sent an email to the parents. And the email said, "As we come to the end of our second week of school, we are also coming to the end of the grace period for being non-compliant." Now, the principal says, "Look, it is my greatest desire not to have to follow the outlined steps of our policy in regards to insubordination when dealing with your children. I'm very fond of your children, but the situation is now becoming critical in terms of not putting your children in the middle of a situation that will result in consequences for them being insubordinate if they refuse to wear a uniform next week." So how did the Frudens respond? Well, they took advantage of one of the many exemptions to the uniform policy and sent their kids to school wearing American Youth Soccer Organization, or ASO, uniforms with black shirts and shorts, and then they filed a lawsuit.
So what did the lawsuit claim, Rob?
Well, so the claim here is that this uniform policy violates the First Amendment. And taking a step back, the Ninth Circuit had already addressed the question of whether uniform policies more generally violate the First Amendment and had said, no, they don't. Requiring somebody to wear khaki pants and a polo shirt is just not a First Amendment violation. But the claim is that this case is different because this uniform is not content neutral. This policy is not content neutral. And that's true for two reasons. One is that the shirt that you're required to wear has this motto on it, "Tomorrow's Leaders." And the second is that it has exemptions, as Sheldon suggested. And one of the exemptions is for nationally recognized youth organizations. And it specifically mentions the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts. And now the school had actually said to these parents and these students, well, your soccer organization shirt doesn't count. It doesn't fall within this exemption, or at least it doesn't fall within the exemption on a day when there's no soccer game. Whereas you could wear a Boy Scout shirt and that'd be fine. And so that, the argument goes, also renders this content discriminatory because you're sort of picking and choosing between different organizations. And now, I think, you know, it's worth saying, I mean, at least to me, you know, the requirement to wear the shirt that says "Tomorrow's Leaders" doesn't really seem like a big deal. You know, it's hard to imagine why you would care. On the other hand, there's a famous Supreme Court case, Woolley versus Maynard, about somebody who objected to having the phrase "live free or die" on their license plate. And to them, that was a really big deal, too. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, you know what? If you don't want to have this phrase "live free or die" on your license plate, you have a constitutional right to cover that up. And, you know, is the phrase "live free or die" any more objectionable than the phrase "Tomorrow's Leaders"? Doesn't really seem like it to me. And, you know, I think it's worth taking a step back, too, and saying, look, even if the phrase "Tomorrow's Leaders" isn't offensive to me or to probably most people who are listening, it obviously was very offensive to this family, so offensive that they were willing to, as the principal said, put their kids in the middle of this situation. I don't know why they cared so much, but they did, and that's worth respecting.
You know, this question came up in the oral argument. Why do you care about the phrase "Tomorrow's Leader" so much? And the parents said, it's not that we object to that phrase, right? We actually don't necessarily have a problem with the phrase. We have a problem with the government telling us that we have to be the ones carrying that phrase on our kids' clothes, right? We don't want to be the government's voice. And, you know, the panel that is deciding this case had a real problem with that. You know, they felt bound by this prior decision by the Ninth Circuit saying that the school had engaged in content-based discrimination by requiring, you know, that particular phrase or by exempting those national organizations. And the panel said, look, we don't really personally have a problem with tomorrow's leaders. It's an, and they say this again and again, this is an anodyne phrase. It really is meaningless. And, you know, any number of mottos could be subject to strict scrutiny if this is subject to strict scrutiny, which it ultimately was. And the panel says, what about a motto like We Succeed Together? Or what about school pride? Or what about Stand Tall? Some students are short. Maybe they would be offended by this. And the panel was really kind of annoyed by this. But on the other hand, during the oral argument, one of the judges, I can't recall who, said, you know, maybe there is something to objecting to the phrase tomorrow's leaders. The school purportedly said that the purpose of putting this phrase on the uniforms was to convey a message that we're all unified, that we're going to be people of good character and dignity, and we want to foster integrity among our students. Well, look at today's leaders. If leadership is such a good virtue, why don't we see that in certain of today's leaders? And there was kind of a lot of laughing in the courtroom as there was a, you know, people were guessing about which leader that the judges were talking about. But to me, it's not entirely, you know, crazy to think that tomorrow's leaders is conveying a particular ideology, a particular message.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And it, you know, it's probably an ideology or a message that most people would find unobjectionable. But in some ways, that just makes it all the more important that you have the right to opt out of it if you want to, because that's really what the First Amendment is about. It's not like we take a vote, and if, you know, 999 out of 1,000 people think something is unobjectionable, then you have to go along with it. Like, that's not how the First Amendment works. You know, another sort of interesting aspect to this case is just the procedural history of it. I think, you know, it's maybe a little wonky, but it's kind of interesting that this case had already gone up on appeal, and there had been a first three-judge panel that had said, and by the way, the district judge clearly just hates these parents, or not hates, but just does not want to rule for these parents. The district judge had ruled against them. It goes up on appeal. The panel says, you know, the first panel says strict scrutiny applies, sends it back down to the district judge. The district judge then says, okay, strict scrutiny applies, but they still lose. It then goes back up on appeal, and this new three-judge panel, it gets assigned to a different panel, says, we don't actually think strict scrutiny should apply. So they actually call themselves for this case to go en banc. And they try to get the full Ninth Circuit to take the case en banc to say that the first panel was wrong. And the entire Ninth Circuit says, no, we don't want to do that. So the initial panel decision stands. And then this second three-judge panel then has to apply a decision that they've already said they disagree with, which, you know, seems right, but also is kind of an interesting little twist.
Well, so that raises an interesting point, which is there's this huge fight between the school and the parents, and also between these two different panels of judges over what level of scrutiny applies in the case. And we've thrown around this phrase, strict scrutiny, and then the alternative test that the Ninth Circuit proposed is intermediate scrutiny. And, you know, why is it so important that for each side to win this debate over what level of scrutiny applies? I think that's one of the more interesting questions that's presented by this case, is just how important it is to win this initial debate over how hard the court is going to take a look at what the government's doing. If it's strict scrutiny, which means that the government has to have a quote, compelling interest, a really strong interest, that interest has to be narrowly tailored. It means it can't be just a very broad program. It has to be narrowly tailored to address that compelling interest, right? Whereas intermediate scrutiny, you know, the bar for the government to prevail gets lowered significantly.
Yeah, and so the, you know, first panel to address this basically said it's strict scrutiny because, you know, it's content-based in these various ways, including the fact that you have to wear a particular message. And the second panel says, no, we don't think strict scrutiny should apply. And their main reason seems to be that the message is so, they use the word anodyne, that this is just like not a political message. It's sort of a platitude that you have to wear on your shirt, which is kind of a weird thing to argue, right? Like that this level of scrutiny that you're going to apply is going to depend on the content of the message that is being that you're being required to endorse. And that is not how we normally do First Amendment scrutiny. It's sort of a surprising thing to even hear them say.
You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting is, you know, we talked about how strict scrutiny works, and you first have to decide whether or not the government has a compelling interest. And as Rob said, there are two claims here. Number one, that tomorrow's leaders is compelled speech. And number two, that you've engaged in content-based discrimination by through this exemption policy by allowing nationally recognized groups but not local groups and other groups, right? And when the court looks at whether or not the government has a compelling interest for tomorrow's leaders, it's interesting. The court says, there can hardly be interests more compelling than fostering children's educational achievement and providing a safe and supportive educational environment, right? So the court says, look, clearly these are compelling interests. The only question then is, does your policy help achieve those interests? And if it does it do so in a narrow way? And the court says, you know, and it doesn't really talk about this in great detail because the school didn't provide much of a defense, but the court says, look, you didn't actually provide any evidence whatsoever that tomorrow's leaders helps achieve the supportive educational environment that that you say will be fostered. You didn't make your case that A leads to B. And I think the reason that the school didn't really do that is because, again, the whole fight has been over this this level of scrutiny up until this point. And I tend to think that the school was pretty comfortable fighting on those grounds and winning that fight, at least at the when all this stuff was getting put in the record, the first round. And then they still won under the district court's analysis. So, you know, it's interesting that that you have that outcome.
Yeah, and this is one of those cases, too, where it's interesting because the whole fight is about the level of scrutiny. And yet, at the end of the day, it's kind of hard to imagine. You know, if you really think, if you think that all of this is just about a silly message that doesn't mean anything and, you know, what's the big deal, then really shouldn't it win under any level of scrutiny?
Right.
And if you really, if you sort of take the other view and you think this is a important principle at issue, I don't see how the school could win under even intermediate scrutiny. So at the end of the day, it seems like the standard review made a difference to the panel. On the other hand, you know, as the district court judge's opinion below sort of suggests, you could come out either way under either standard.
Well, you know, you remind me of an interesting piece by Eugene Volokh, I think in the late 90s, where he looks at this idea of strict scrutiny and kind of says that this whole test ends up being, even under strict scrutiny, ends up being very manipulable, right? What you determine is a compelling interest can lead to all sorts of crazy outcomes, and that it's not very principled in the way that it's being applied. Eugene Volokh actually, in the first time this was heard by the Ninth Circuit, he argued on behalf of the Frudens, and then he argued as an amicus when this came up the second time. So he's been very heavily involved in this case. But I think that's right. That all these fights about levels of scrutiny tend to obscure the reality, which is that it doesn't really matter what you call it. If you're putting a heavy thumb on the scale in favor of the government, that's what's going to determine what the outcome is, no matter what you call the particular test.
Yeah, although, and it's interesting, right? I mean, this is sort of an age-old question. Do levels of scrutiny matter? And on the one hand, I think there's a very good case to be made that they don't. On the other hand, when you kind of look at the decision of the panel here, they seem to be saying that if strict scrutiny didn't apply, the school would win. But its school loses because they're bound to say that strict scrutiny does apply. So, you know, maybe the answer is strict scrutiny only matters, or the level of scrutiny only matters if the judges think it matters. And this is a case where the judges think it does.
Okay. And with that, let's move on to the next case, which also comes out of the Ninth Circuit. Rob?
All right. So this is a case about weddings. This, you have a fellow who bought a 40-acre parcel of land in a rural area surrounded by farms on either side. And he planted it with gardens. And he thought, hey, you know what? I've got this beautiful piece of land. People are going to want to come here. They're going to want to have weddings. This is going to be a great wedding venue. And so he applies for a permit because in order to have an outdoor event like a wedding in this area, under the applicable zoning laws, you need to have an outdoor use permit. He applies to have about 60 weddings a year. And the initial recommendation from the zoning board or zoning agency is to grant this permit. And then it goes to a hearing, and the neighbors show up at the hearing. And the neighbors are, for whatever reason, not into the idea of having weddings. I don't know why, but they don't like the idea. So then it comes out of this hearing with a recommendation, let's actually deny the permit. And at the end of the day, the permit gets denied. And the board, in making the decision to deny it, makes some factual findings, including that the use of this land for weddings would be, quote, not compatible with the rural community surrounding the venue. Now, what does that exactly mean? Well, who knows? And obviously, the board initially thought that it was compatible because they were going to grant it. Then they changed their mind. And so this fellow who owns this piece of land, he files suit and he claims that the denial of this permit violates the First Amendment.
Sheldon, what does the court make of that?
Well, the court first has to grapple with this first argument that the government raises, which is that Michael Fowler and Epona LLC don't have standing. The government claims that the injured parties, if you can't hold a wedding, are the bride and groom, right? It's not the company. The company that's hosting the wedding, the venue isn't the one that's injured.
Or at least not injured in a
First Amendment sense. Right. Not injured in a First Amendment sense, in that their speech rights, their expressive rights, their religious rights, however you want to characterize, you know, the particular First Amendment interest, that interest belongs to the bride and groom and not to the company. And so the court has to grapple with that. Well, is that true? Does the wedding vendor have any interest at all in this type of question? And this is an interesting question to be asking, because it kind of plays out in a lot of other contexts these days. Just what exactly is the relationship between the First Amendment and the person or company that's providing services or a venue for the bride and groom? How much of it gets kind of to be imputed to the wedding vendor? In this instance, the court says, well, you know, if you apply the permitting scheme to commercial weddings, well, first of all, it causes an economic injury, right? So there's some sort of economic injury to the vendor if you say that they can't hold the wedding, right? If Epona LLC had gone ahead and organized the wedding without authorization, then it would have been the business and not the bride and groom that would have been in trouble for hosting that wedding, right? So it is really still an injury, a First Amendment injury that is being borne by the company. Now I was Googling this company, Epona LLC, and I found this interesting website called WeddingWire.com that kind of provides all sorts of reviews and stuff for wedding vendors. And Epona LLC has a 2.5 out of 5 star review. It actually has two reviews. One is a 0-star review and one is a 5-star review. There's the 5-star review says, Epona Estate is absolutely gorgeous. We loved it. They were great. It was wonderful. Okay, so what's the 0.0 star review? And I think this goes to, you know, an example of what the harm really is here, right? And it looks like Epona had organized a wedding about a year out. They agreed to do a wedding. It was going to be an $11,000 venue fee, but they ended up not being able to get the permit, so they had to cancel the wedding, right? And as a consequence, this couple was understandably very upset. They said, we received a phone call that the venue does not have their conditional use permit, and they're having issues getting it, so they waited until the 180th day before our wedding, because our contract said they could cancel up to 180 days in advance. And this person was understandably frustrated that the wedding had to be canceled. So Epona is out money, and not only that, but it has some reputational issues because it couldn't get the conditional permit. So despite the government's claim that the company shouldn't have any standing, I think the court reached the right conclusion that clearly there's an injury to Epona if they're prohibited from holding these weddings on their property.
Yeah, and this is something that courts call third-party standing, and it's the sort of principle that allows doctors to sue to uphold the abortion rights of patients, and liquor stores to sue to uphold the rights of people who buy liquor from them. I mean, it's an old principle that has been around for a long time, and it seems that it's rightly applied in this case. And so then you get to the question of, well, is there actually a First Amendment violation here? And the The court says that there is, and they say that there is for two reasons. Essentially, if you have a permitting scheme that implicates the First Amendment, the decision maker who's deciding whether to issue these permits or not has to have some sort of a standard that they're applying. They can't just have unbridled discretion to grant or not grant permits. And then the other sort of thing that applies is that they have to have a time limit within which they have to make this decision. You can't just have somebody, you can't, if you want to do something that implicates your First Amendment rights, you can't be basically sitting around with your hands under your seat waiting
for someone
to issue
a decision.
So if
you file an application for a permit, you can't make someone wait for a year, 2 years, there has to be a deadline for the county to act.
Right, exactly. And I think in some ways that actually goes to the example that Sheldon was just reading us from the internet that, that they were waiting to get a decision on the permit and then they had to cancel because the sort of time was running out on the cancellation under the contract. And, that has all sorts of implications. So the requirement that you have to have a deadline to get a decision has actually really important consequences for people. And in this case, the permitting scheme fails both of these requirements. There are standards that are applied, but the standards are very, very malleable, essentially saying, is it compatible with the character of the community? And this goes back to the fact findings that the zoning board made when they denied the permit. They're basically saying it's not compatible with the community. Well, what does that really mean? I mean, that's sort of up to the eye of the beholder, right? And so it sounds legal-like. It sounds like you're applying some kind of a standard. But at the end of the day, it's really just kind of up to you whether you think that is satisfied or not. And then, sort of just looking at the law, it had no time limit where you had to issue a decision.
Yeah, when you look at the quote-unquote factual findings by the commission that denied the permit, you mentioned that it said that the venue is not compatible with the rural community. Well, what does that even mean, right? In what way is something compatible with a rural community or not? When I read that, I thought, I got to see this. It must look really weird and out of place with the rest of the rural community. So I pulled up Google Maps and looked at the satellite images. And honestly, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between Opponent Estates and the neighboring, agricultural farms from the air, right? So then you go down, you'll look at the pictures of the venue, and to me it looks like this very beautiful wedding venue that's on this sprawling, fairly empty estate, right? I don't see that it's any different from the rest of the community around it. But I think that just highlights how easy it is to manipulate a standard like this if it's a standardless standard.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about this case, though, really is sort of think about it. What if instead of holding a wedding, you wanted to hold some other kind of a party, a birthday party or a sweet 16 party or a retirement party? At that point, it's a lot less clear that the First Amendment would apply because, you're not holding a religious event like a wedding. It doesn't have the same implications as a wedding. And at that point, they could deny the permit, potentially, at least the opinion suggests, for any reason that they want. And indeed, this kind of permitting decision under these kind of malleable standards, that's just how zoning works. Like this is like zoning 101. And it's only because it's a First Amendment case that that's mm-hmm. not appropriate, which is, that's not wrong, but it's a little weird, right? That if you're going to hold a wedding, you get all these constitutional rights. But if you're going to hold some other kind of event,
right,
maybe not.
Okay, that's two engaged decisions out of two so far. So, Rob, let's move to the Sixth Circuit. Are we going to make it a trifecta today?
Sure. So,
no, we're not.
Yeah, answer is no. Although a good dissent, so that's something. This is a case out of the Sixth Circuit. It's a fellow named Latitz, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, is stopped by the police. They are asking him to get his identification. He reaches into the glove box, and as he's reaching in there, they see some baggies of what they think are marijuana. He kind of clumsily tries to hide them under the seat of his car. The officer asks him to step out, and in the course of doing this, draws his gun and points it at his head briefly. And the suspect or the driver, whatever you want to call him, drives away. Probably not the wisest decision, but there you go. And what follows is what you might call a moderately high-speed chase. This is not like driving along at 150 miles an hour. The speed during the chase tops out at about 55 miles an hour. So,
and it's the middle of the night and the streets are empty. So, you know, it's
like the O.J. Simpson chase, right? The slow white Bronco.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not a low speed chase, but it's not a high speed chase. It's sort of in the middle.
It's like Star Wars Last Jedi, right? The very slow speed chase with, is that a spoiler?
I don't know. Yeah. All right. So anyway, so the cops are following along, and finally he's making all kinds of fancy maneuvers, trying to get away from them, and one of them just rams him off the road. He's then sort of trying to drive back onto the road, and one of the cops kind of positions his car so that he can't do that. There's a sort of the car, two cars hit each other, but apparently hit each other so slowly that the police car isn't even damaged. And then one of the police officers gets out of his car. And he stands behind the fleeing suspect's vehicle. And as the vehicle sort of is maneuvering, trying to get out, he takes out his gun and he shoots this man.
Actually, I don't think that's quite right. I think he's to the side of the vehicle. And as the fleeing motorist reverses, not into the path of the officer fires.
Yeah, well, he's approaching from the rear and the person is backing up. But you're right, he's not directly behind. The important point is he's not in the path of the vehicle. He is sort of behind and to the side of it.
That's
my understanding. The important point is that he is not in any immediate danger.
Nor is anyone else.
And neither is anybody else, exactly. And then, interesting sort of coda to the story, he actually is then fired for three reasons, because he's violated the policies of the department in three ways. One is that he wasn't supposed to be part of this chase at all, because there were already two cars part of the chase, two police cars.
And he overtook. So he's the third arriving officer, and he overtook the first two, which you're not supposed to do.
Exactly. The second reason, he rammed the car off the road in violation of a direct order. And then the third reason is he was supposed to, instead of getting up and running up to the car, he was supposed to shelter behind his own car to not put himself in danger. So three violations of the department's own policies, he is fired. And then there's a suit saying that, you know, he shouldn't have shot this guy, that was a violation of the Constitution, excessive use of deadly force. And the panel actually agrees. They say, nobody was in any danger, and you can't just shoot someone because they're running away. They actually have to pose a danger to somebody before you shoot them. But, and this is where the non-engaged part comes in, the panel says qualified immunity applies. So even though the officer violated the Constitution, no remedy at all. And what the court says is basically, well, sure, there's all these decisions saying you can't shoot somebody just because they're running away. But none of those decisions involve exactly the same set of facts. Like in some of them, the person was just getting into his car, whereas here the guy was already in his car, or in some of them, the person was about to start driving away, but here he had been driving away for several minutes and then had stopped, and there's been stuff that happened in the middle, yada, yada, yada. And basically what you get the sense is, like, you have to have had, like, the guy with the same name and the same birthday doing exactly the same thing, or, like, maybe it's unclear and so qualified immunity applies. And what the dissent says, I think rightly, is that this kind of approach erects a nearly impenetrable barrier for people who are trying to vindicate their constitutional rights.
And we've discussed a qualified immunity a bunch of times on this show, but we felt compelled to include this one as well, because it's just so obvious that courts can manipulate the standard if they're so inclined. Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, commandeering you to get engaged. Thank you.